This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Welcome to Rex Factor.
This time, the Battle of the Raucous Royals, live!
With your hosts, Graham Duke and Ali Hood.
Hello!
Hello!
And welcome to Rex Factor, where, as I've said every time, hilariously, we're not in Oxford.
Oxford.
When were we live in Oxford, Ali?
November-ish.
November 2018, on our first live tour, the third of six live tours? Shows.
Shame. So we're halfway through at this point.
We're halfway through. We've got a day off next night.
Well, actually, I suppose we're halfway through at the end of this.
Yes, that's true. Mm. Yes. And when we were in Oxford, we did the Battle of the
Raucous Royals.
Very well remembered.
Yeah, thank you very much.
So this was Charles II against George IV.
Mm-hmm.
Now, unfortunately, for some reason, the sound cut out during the bad subjectivity for George IV.
Oh, right.
Section. So we don't have the whole of the live episode, unfortunately.
Right.
Which is a bit of a shame. We don't know why that happened, but it just did. So for anyone who asked a question in the Q&A, I'm afraid that won't be included.
Mm.
But what we're going to do is play you the episode up to the point at which it cuts out, and then Ali and I will fill you in at the end as to what happened.
Oh, hang on, I'm out of depth. I don't know.
I will fill you in as to what happened.
Okay, good.
But for now, here is the Battle of the Raucous Royals, Charles II against George IV.
Shh! You're in the library, Oxford! The time is 7 p.m. Give or take a number of minutes. You just checked that, didn't you? It's Rex Factor, live! With your hosts, Graham Duke and Ali Hood.
Hello, and thank you for coming. And we should say that introduction, we have been getting increasingly worse at getting a dramatic entrance. So when we were at London for our first night, we had to go out the side door, hide outside for a few minutes, wait for everybody else to come in before then we came back in.
Great success, though. It was, you know, we actually came onto a stage, which was great. It worked really well.
Last night in Bristol, the sound guy was taking so long that we hadn't had a chance to go and get any food or go to the toilet. So our attempts at a sudden, unexpected entrance and a little cubbyhole was foiled by the fact that Ali had to come back in with his bag of burgers. And I had to actually queue to get back in after the toilet. So today we haven't even actually managed to leave the stage. We just sat here. So apologies if it's been a bit weird, us just sitting here looking at you.
So I like the idea that that's what they think that we do all the time, just wait to podcast until we do another one. Hello, Graham.
Yeah. Suddenly switch on.
Yeah.
Yeah, so thank you very much, everybody, for coming. This is the third of the Rex Factor live tour of this year. And Ali, what are we going to be doing tonight?
It is the, I'm not going to get the wording right, the Battle of the Raucous Royals. So that is, I'm not saying notes. So we've got Charles II, obviously, and George IV.
And you do want to do it in your podcast voice.
Oh, I see.
So that we can do it later.
Okay, got you. Okay. This time, the Battle of the Raucous Royals. I always have to say this every night, but I always do the hands. I don't know why. I can't do it without doing the hands. It must annoy you so much to see. It annoys me.
So every night we're doing a battle between two of the monarchs that we've reviewed from previous series. So tonight's one, we are doing two of the more partying, scandalous monarchs, Charles II and George IV, which was a suggestion by somebody in the audience, I believe, on Twitter. We thought it was such a good one.
Oh, no.
And she was like, come. And it was bad. It was bad luck because then tickets became available. So we tweeted her, but then she'd made other arrangements, so she missed out twice. Well, in her honour, we're going to be doing Charles II and George IV.
I've got this ready.
Yeah, that may break.
Yes.
So your key question today, I think, is going to be whose party would you rather attend, Charles's?
Oh, good.
Or George's?
Good, good, good. I mean, this is genuinely all brand new to me, and we've never scripted anything. I mean, Graham has some bullet points that he tries to hit, but other than that...
I mean, when we say brand new, you mean other than the two podcast episodes that you have
doesn't count
already
for anything,
forgotten.
Graham. Absolutely nothing.
So, quick overview of the two monarchs before we go into their lives and reigns. Charles II, first of all, born in 1630 and became king in 1660, so he was 30 years old when he came to the throne. He was about 6'2", very tall. That's our third in a row, in fact, that was 6'2", because
we had Edward and...
Edward I and Henry VIII last night. Quite a dark complexion, Charles II. Black hair, dark brown eyes. Bit of a spaniel look to him.
Straight away. Where's that come from?
Just the hair over his ears.
Wasn't it a wig in those days? Or was it pre-wig?
He did have a wig. I'm not sure if it was pre-wig and then he needed a wig to maintain it or if it was just a wig post-wig. Right. But Samuel Tyke in 1660 described him. He said, his face is rather grave, but softened whensoever he speaks. His complexion is somewhat dark, but his eyes are quick and sparkling. His hair, which he hath in great plenty, is of a shining black, not frizzled, but so naturally curling into great rings that it is a very comely ornament.
Oh, nice. Not an ornament. Sounds like Bess of Hardwick with all of her gear up in her hair.
Georgina.
We'd normally cut these things.
Although some of those equally, I would definitely leave it.
Yeah, I've got no say over that. It's annoying.
And in terms of his personality, he is, of course, remembered as the merry monarch. Affable, free from graces, witty sense of humour, a bawdy court, but also a little bit of a cynical and shrewd politician behind the smiles.
Yeah, my favourite.
John Evelyn said he was a prince of many virtues and many great imperfections. Debonair, easy of access, not bloody or cruel.
Right. Easy of access. What do we mean there?
Well, let's leave that open to interpretation. George IV was born in 1762, and he doesn't become king until 1820 when he was 57 years old.
Not good for his overall rec factor.
Not good for longevity. Georgiana, the Duchess of Devonshire, described him as a young man, saying that the prince is rather tall and has a figure which, though striking, is not perfect. He is inclined to be too fat and looks too much like a woman in men's clothes. But his face is very handsome, and he is fond of dress even to a tawdry degree, which, young as he is, will soon wear off. An incorrect prediction at the end there from Georgiana.
Yeah, yeah. So what did you say about looking like a woman? Too much like a woman?
In men's clothes.
So she's implying that it's like a sweet spot, where you can look just enough like a woman. Okay.
In terms of his personality, he is, of course, notorious as the Prince Regent. He wore excessively gaudy clothes, grew rather large with continual feasting, but he was actually quite kind-natured, wore his emotions on his sleeve, and he was quite able, but he struggled to find a role whilst his father was king.
How constitutional is he at this point? Like, how much power did he have?
He does theoretically have some power, but it's significantly less than when Charles was king. It was really after 1688 and William III that the power of the monarchy starts to decline.
So he's just got time to eat.
He's got plenty of time to eat. So let's look at their lives and reigns. Ali, do you remember what you're going to say next?
Battliness!
No.
What? Biography. I've been practicing that. I've done it wrong every single night because you normally do. We haven't done biography.
We don't usually have that in the podcast. We've done it every night though.
But because people laugh at that, but I did that 10 years ago nearly now. I've never done it since. Now all of a sudden I can't remember them.
So Charles II, a bit of backgroundy stuff for Charles II. His father, Charles I, clashed with Parliament over, he believed in the divine rights of monarchy, whereas Parliament believed in, you know, Parliament. Mm. And this ultimately leads to the Civil War, culminating in Charles I being executed and Oliver Cromwell setting up a republic. The monarchy is no more.
Mm. How long was that for?
Well, we'll find out.
Oh, okay, good.
Cromwell is introduces a puritanical regime, so we see theatres and Christmas band, but he struggles to really make it work as a long-lasting replacement for the system of monarchy.
I'm not surprised. It sounds dull.
It does sound dull, yeah. Doesn't it? Well, thankfully, we've got Charles II going.
Brilliant.
Charles was actually crowned King of Scots in 1651, but he was defeated in the Battle of Worcester by Cromwell and spent 6 weeks as a fugitive before escaping to France, where he spent the next 9 years in exile.
He was King of Scots?
He was crowned King of Scots and then was going to try and come into England and re-establish himself, but he failed.
Ah, because, yeah, it's post-James VI and everything. So
yes.
He was still King of Scotland, even when he was trying to be...
Well, he was after Charles was executed. Charles I was executed. Charles II was crowned King of Scots.
Right.
As a, you know, as a form of resistance to Cromwell.
Oh, okay. But no power because Cromwell was still kicking around.
Yes, and indeed he kicked Charles.
No power at all.
Indeed. So he goes off to France for 9 years, but when Cromwell died in 1658 and his son Richard was quite ineffective, there's a fear that there's going to be civil war again, it's going to break out. They don't really have a clear way to fill that power vacuum. So negotiations take place, and they think the best thing to do is to invite Charles II back, and we have the restoration of the monarchy.
Hey!
So in 1660, Charles II becomes king. He lifts all of these puritanical bans, promotes religious toleration despite the rather Anglican parliament, marries Catherine of Braganza, which got off to a bit of a bad start. She wore her hair in ringlets, so he looked at her and exclaimed, "They've bought me a bat."
I forgot that. Yeah, this is all coming back. Brilliant.
But he does come to care for her quite deeply.
Mind you, he looked like a spaniel.
Well, he's like, yeah. So, well, I mean, it's not an ideal match.
Mm, yeah. Well, they can't mate.
Well, indeed. Yeah. You are starting to remember this, aren't you?
Oh. I see where you're going with that. No, I wasn't.
London has some difficult times in the 1660s. There's a great plague in 1665, which is the last wave of the Black Death. Something like 100,000 people die as a result of this. And then the next year, 1666, we have the Great Fire of London.
Mm.
Charles and his brother James are on hand to try and put it out, but a lot of the medieval city is destroyed. In terms of his foreign policy, in 1661, we have Louis XIV reaching his majority in France, and he is very much the big power in Europe. Charles becomes something of a vassal to Louis. He's got Catholic sympathies, having been in France for many years. And he actually gained a pension from Louis with a secret treaty pledging to restore England to Catholicism.
Oh, that's bad news for England, isn't it? That's why they kicked out James.
Because he was a Catholic, yeah. He launches unpopular and unsuccessful wars against William of Orange, the future William III.
Huh.
And as you said, the big problem is that Catholicism, his wife is a Catholic and proved unable to have children. Because of the whole bat spaniel thing that we've described earlier. And his brother James is openly Catholic, and Parliament fears that they are going to see despotic Catholic rule if he becomes James II.
Yeah.
So we actually have various bills put before Parliament calling for James to be excluded from the throne.
Mm.
And this really comes to a point of hysteria when a chap called Titus Oates made various bogus claims of a Catholic conspiracy.
Who's he? Why were people listening to him?
Well, it's just publicised, really, and he makes a big song and dance about it, and everyone is whipped up into hysteria. We've got Parliament petitioning Charles to get his brother out of the form of succession. Charles is now in fighting against Parliament. It's all starting to get a little bit too redolent of the 1640s.
Mm.
Thankfully, though, his enemies in Parliament overplay their hand somewhat. There's a discovery of a murder plot in 1683 for Charles and James to be killed, and this rather taints, by association, his opponents.
Ah, good.
In
good.
Parliament.
Right, so, but presumably Charles didn't want them to get rid of his brother.
He did not, he opposed it.
But he similarly didn't want anyone who was massively religious one way or the other.
Well, he just believed, you know, it's his brother, that's the next person in line.
Okay. Right. Mm-hmm.
So he has succeeded in seeing them off, and after that he doesn't actually need to call Parliament anymore because he's getting plenty of money from the French, so
brilliant.
Problem solved. But unfortunately, Charles doesn't have very long to enjoy it. In 1685, he suffered an unexpected stroke, or perhaps convulsions due to a kidney disease, and he was no more. He apologised for being such an unconscionable time dying.
Oh, that's brilliant. Apologising for dying.
Sorry this is taking so long.
We had an incident today. We were having some lunch, and I was standing up really quickly. I did something similar where I got the procedure the wrong way round, apologised, and then jumped up and knocked everything off the table. And I felt it was, we nearly started talking about this. So save it. We've got a gig tonight.
He asked for his curtains to be drawn one last time so that he could see dawn rise above the River Thames. And he died at the age of 54, being received into the Catholic faith on his deathbed. And bidding James to take care of his mistress.
It was nearly so beautiful. And then he goes...
So that was Charles II. What about George IV? Background stuff for him. His father, George III, is actually quite a successful and popular monarch for most of his reign. Except in America.
American fans in the front there.
But for George IV, it wasn't a very pleasant childhood because George III was obsessed with morality and this public image. So there's a very strict childhood regime for George. And as such, he becomes a bit of a rebellious young prince. He has numerous affairs with actresses. 1785, he was secretly and illegally married a Catholic woman, Maria Fitzherbert. Ooh. And he also befriends various radical politicians that his father hated, particularly Charles James Fox.
Just to annoy his dad?
Just to annoy his dad, really.
But really? So was it like a power thing? Was he trying to... Because I know he formed that other little power section. But he was going to come to power eventually anyway. Why couldn't he just party?
Well, I mean, his dad... Well, he did party. That's what he did. He went to lots of parties, and that's what the radical politicians did as well.
Oh, okay.
Charles James Fox was the one that went to a party and won something like £10,000 by getting people to bet on whether or not he had defecated in his own trousers. And he won the bet because although everybody thought he had because it smelt so bad, he'd actually paid a servant to do it for him so that it wasn't actually his own soiled sample, it was a servant's.
That is worth 10 grand, isn't it? Now that's worth 10 grand, let alone then. God. Any offers?
But his father is struck down by mental health problems, possibly porphyria, still being debated. So in 1788, we have a regency crisis because everybody thinks that George is such a terrible rotter, you couldn't possibly have him actually in control.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a bit of a standoff with William Pitt and the radicals, but thankfully for them, George III at this point recovers and there is no regency.
Okay, he must have been annoyed when he got better.
George III or...?
George III. Well, actually, both of them. George III.
Neither of them are in a good mood.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Yeah. He's now had a little taste of power, likes it.
Well, he didn't get any power. He almost got a taste of power. They didn't actually let him be regent.
Clever.
Put it off long enough that they didn't have to. And also, actually, George IV, not that he's actually George IV yet, but he's massively in debt because of all his gambling and parties and actresses and whatnot. So his father refuses to pay him unless he starts to reform his behaviour and actually marries.
But he already has.
Technically, he has already married, but his father doesn't know about this.
Oh, God.
So instead, George marries Caroline of Brunswick, his first cousin.
Ooh. So he's married secretly and possibly illegally.
Yes.
And then marries his first cousin.
Yes.
So he's a bigamist and incest.
Yes.
Right. Good. It's powerful stuff already. He's not king.
And it's not a particularly good marriage. They absolutely hate each other right from the off.
Oh.
They do manage to produce a daughter, but pretty much immediately separate after that.
This is Pineapple Head, isn't it?
No, that's his younger brother, William IV.
All right, okay, fine. I was because of the middle, yeah.
Hugh Laurie and Blackadder.
Yes, got him, right there, yeah.
Now, in 1810, George III does fall permanently ill with whatever his mental health issues were. So this time, George does become the Prince Regent.
Right.
He's got some real power. Mm. And it's a renowned period for his patronage of the arts. We see the end to the Napoleonic Wars with Waterloo, but also we've got poor harvest and socio-economic unrest. So it's, you know, some positives and negatives as we see in subjectivity for this period. And he finally becomes king 10 years later in 1820.
Right. Okay. That's pretty good time for the British Empire and all the power and all this sort of stuff. End of the Napoleon War, as you say.
Yeah, exactly. So Caroline, having been separated from him, now comes back because she fancies being queen.
Yeah.
George, of course, his main priority as king is to make sure he can divorce his wife.
Well, there's a precedent for that now, isn't there, with, after Henry?
Well, and he does rather better than Henry, to be fair. So he has to urge Parliament to grant him this divorce. And it is just passed very narrowly, though public opinion is actually against him.
He has to ask Parliament, but isn't he in charge of the church?
It doesn't quite work as easily as that now. Yeah. There's got some laws and stuff in place that Henry didn't have to worry about.
Yeah, we just killed him.
Yeah. So, he becomes king. He becomes king, divorces his wife, and surprisingly has quite a good start to his reign. He enjoys some very successful tours of Ireland and Scotland, and also Hanover from 1820 to 21. It doesn't really follow it up very much, but still, he had a good time.
Good. So when you say tours, you mean...
He went there.
He just went there and carried on doing his partying there, but was present.
And invited people.
Oh, okay.
So it all seemed nice. And we also have Catholic emancipation, so that Catholics are allowed to actually hold public office and all this sort of thing.
That's been a few hundred years.
Indeed. But unfortunately, all these years of partying have rather caught up with Georgie Porcy. Excessive eating and drinking took its toll on him. He suffered gout and rheumatism, went blind in one eye, severe breathlessness. He was ultimately too embarrassed to be seen in public because of his appearance, he'd wear sort of really massive dark clothes and be all swaddled up in his chariots. Apparently, 1829, he was seen by a dentist 27 times. And the dentist in 1829 is not to be visited once if you really have to. So in 1830, it all gets a bit too much for him. He woke up at 2 o'clock in the morning, not feeling too well. He took some medicine and some tea and went to sleep. But then at 3 o'clock, a blood vessel burst in his stomach. So he clutched his physician and cried, "Good God, what is this? My boy, this is death." And promptly died at the age of 67.
Wow. Well, he had foresight, didn't he? He knew exactly what was coming. They were definitely his final words. The physician recorded it. Yeah. Wow, brilliant. I like a punchy end like that. Like Charles had one, but then ruined it a bit with his lechery.
Let not poor Nelly starve.
Oh. Who was the fellow who said about take care of my mistress?
Well, that's Charles. Nelly is the mistress.
Ah, yes, got you. Yep. Good. Well, because when you said take care...
Oh, I see. No, he didn't mean that. No.
No. Well, I mean, it's classic Charles. I bet he did mean that. And they just translated it back to something a bit more ambiguous.
So what do you think then? The two of them together, those lives and reigns, any initial thoughts before we start to look at the factors?
Oh, well, I was really worried about this one because they're two... I always like kings that I think you just want to be their mates. They just seem like nice guys. It's beyond the time when they really were killing everyone left, right, and center, and they just sort of liked to have a nice time. So and seemed fun. So probably with that in mind, Charles.
Well, you don't have to decide yet.
No, well, like, each factor by factor, I think
they're quite interesting. Like they both have to play a waiting game, so they basically have sort of a good decade where they've sort of got power, but technically not. So we've got Charles when he was crowned King of Scots after his father died, but he doesn't actually get to be king. And we've got George IV as the Prince Regent, where he's not actually technically king.
I think it's George's is easier, though, because though he's not technically king, he's there in England knowing he will be king and partying, whereas Charles is out in the wilderness
making sure he doesn't get his head cut off.
A lot more difficult. I'm surprised he's so chipper after all that.
Perhaps significantly for their personalities, they also both follow periods of sort of Puritanism and moralistic
people
as well. And they are perhaps quite a strong reaction against that
interesting
previous
parallels,
culture.
Shall
we look at it factor by factor if you can remember the
order? I'll get it right this time. Battliness!
Hey. This is not perhaps the best category for either Charles II or George IV. For Charles, at the Battle of Edge Hill in the Civil War in 1642, he did brandish a pistol and shout defiantly at the enemy.
That is terrifying. So you've got a spaniel waving something in the air going...
12 years old.
Oh, sweetie. Just trying to defend his dad.
Yeah.
Oh. It's not good, though. Sweet, but not good.
And he showed some leadership and bravery at the Battle of Worcester.
Which one was that?
That was the one that he lost.
Ah.
And then had to flee the country.
Not good. Not good.
So perhaps not the best. And obviously when he becomes king, it's by invitation rather than conquest.
Yeah. Did he start any wars or?
Well, again, we'll have a little look at that. Perhaps not very successfully, but yes.
All right, good.
His marriage to Catherine of Braganza brings Tangiers and Bombay into English ownership.
Oh, interesting.
But in terms of actual world domination, Louis XIV, very much the power horse at this stage. England is not a grand empire under Charles.
No.
So you asked about, does he start any wars? Well, he does start wars with the Dutch.
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah, that doesn't go well, does it?
Well, 1665, the Battle of Lowestoft, an invading Dutch fleet was defeated in battle by his brother James.
Ah, yeah, right. Not good. Well, that's pretty good because it's under his reign.
Yeah.
Yeah, all right, fine.
Less good was the raid on the Medway in 1667 when the Dutch invaded again. 13 British ships were lost and the flagship, the one that brought Charles back from exile, was captured.
That's the one I was thinking of, yeah. Mm. Yeah. What I can't understand is this all because he was in Louis's pocket?
Yes, because technically, really, England is meant to be a Protestant country.
Yeah,
the Dutch are Protestant,
allies.
And yet we're making war with the Dutch.
So did everyone know that the king was just basically in the French king's pocket?
They didn't know that he'd signed the secret treaty. I suppose the word secret there being the...
But everyone must have gone, there must be a secret treaty going on. But... Weren't people annoyed that?
Well, he drew up a sort of found excuses to do it, but yeah, it wasn't a popular war, particularly when they lost.
Yeah, all right.
So really, the main thing for Charles is actually that Battle of Worcester in 1651, where he was decisively defeated. So his most famous battle-y escapade is actually spending 6 weeks running away.
Oh, and yes, I love this. Are we going to do his...
We are, because it is quite fun. Fantastic. There's a reward of £1,000 for his capture after he flees from the battle.
That's a tenth of a pair of trousers.
He had to hide up a tree in Boscobel, Royal Oak.
The Royal Oak, yeah.
Son of Royal Oak is still there today.
There's a Royal Oak pub near me with a tree and a picture of Charles's face in it, but it's near Maldon. It's nowhere near where the Royal Oak was. So I guess this is just like the King's Head. Just
I think many pub names are not necessarily...
Oh, I thought it was unique to there. Oh, I thought
it's
it was
one of the most popular pub names in the country, I believe.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Oh, shut me up. No, I'm there. I have been to pubs. This isn't my first time.
He wanted to go across into Wales initially, but he had to turn back to Stratford when he saw that the route was blocked, and then Cirencester. He stopped at Stonehenge just to do a spot of sightseeing.
So good, yeah. Why not? He's in the area. Yeah. He might not ever come back.
You'd regret it if you don't go.
Yeah, yeah. You could touch them then as well. So.
Well, he did, so he went around counting them, because apparently it was impossible to count them twice and get to the same number. But he did.
Yeah, quite right. Yeah, obviously.
He eventually made it to Brighton and then boarded a ship to France at Shoreham. But he shows a lot of initiative. It's not perhaps battling initiative, but nevertheless, he gets himself out of a scrape. He really enjoyed dressing up and being in disguise.
Oh, yes, he did.
Face and hands were stained with walnut juice, and he liked to dress up as woodcutters and servants and people like that, put on funny voices. He loved playing characters. He really tested it as well. So there's one time he actually asked somebody what the king looked like and was told he was a good 3 inches taller than Charles himself. But this means he's one of the only kings that actually really gets to experience life of his ordinary subjects, because he did have to live in cramped conditions, make his own way amongst the people.
It just strikes me as completely unaware of how serious the situation was. he sort of thought, brilliant. Here's a chance I can play spy and go off and dress up. Who shall I be today? I'm going to be a stable boy and get play with his fancy dress box. Did he understand that he would get killed?
Well, I guess we'll never know.
Just either that or he's got an incredible bravery as well. So that's sort of battliness.
There we go. We're getting a little bit in there.
Yeah.
Let's see George IV's efforts.
Okay.
In some ways, it's far, far better. We've got, with apologies to the War of 1812.
Oh, yes. Do we burn down the...
Well, let's see. The British view of this is not necessarily the same. It's maybe let's call it a score draw. The America don't take Canada from the British, but equally the British aren't able to then push back in. But they do burn down the White House.
And, sorry.
But in typical British fashion, they saw that dinner had been prepared, so the officers sat down, ate the dinner, and then burned out. Apparently, there's a really terrible, well, a very fortuitous storm that actually prevented the entire building being completely destroyed. So that actually is why it was preserved. Yeah.
Was it? Is any of the current White House that White House?
Hmm. Is it just rebuilt? It's all destroyed.
Oh.
Oh well, yeah, that'll do it. Anyway, so that's a
positive.
Bigger and I think more unequivocally successful are the Napoleonic Wars.
Yeah.
Napoleon is defeated, and it's under the regency of George that we have the ultimate battle at Waterloo. Duke of Wellington leads Britain to victory, and Napoleon is stopped.
That's huge, isn't it? That was the war of the century, that one.
Yeah.
Until the First World War, that was the one that people look back on, and it was under his reign.
Exactly.
Pretty good. Though, at this point in the series, were we judging kings on what happened during their reign, even if they weren't actually...
We were involved? Giving them credit for things that happened during their reign, but George was a firm supporter of Wellington, very committed to the cause. Unfortunately, he wasn't actually given any kind of role himself. He kind of wanted one, but his father thought it was too risky for the heir to be exposed to military things going on, so refused all of his requests. But in 1811, when he was a regent, he made himself a field marshal and designed himself a special uniform, which apparently weighed 200 pounds.
What was it? A tank?
He also got a little bit delusional, so he actually came to believe that he was the one that created the Grand European Alliance that defeated Napoleon. Right. And he even came to believe and tell everybody that he led a victorious cavalry charge at Waterloo. So the Duke of Wellington, when George told him this, said, "So you have told me, sir, but I did not witness this marvellous charge."
He actually told Wellington.
He told the Duke of Wellington that he had led the victorious charge at Waterloo.
Was he mad?
Quite possibly a little bit. Ooh, a little bit off there.
Certainly eccentric.
So... neither of them were perhaps personally very successful in battliness.
Mm.
I suppose George does technically have the Battle of Waterloo, and if he did lead the victorious charge, that would be very impressive.
Amazing, yeah. Oh, tricky, isn't it? Because in Charles's time, he did have kings on the battlefield, but there just wasn't the... He was 12 when he waved his little pistol.
Yeah. But they both have anecdotes, though. Charles loved to tell everybody about his escape from Cromwell, and George liked to tell everybody that he won the Battle of Waterloo. So,
yeah, at least
they both thought that they were very good at battliness.
At least he did actually do an escape, which was sort of an adventure. But George had all this great stuff happening under him, but nothing to do with him.
No.
So again, a score draw maybe.
Hmm.
Ooh, scandal!
Well, I think this is what we've all come for tonight. You ready?
Yeah.
Charles II, first of all, his court is renowned for its debauchery.
Yeah.
Late night partying, very little evidence of work going on. One of the chief men and one of his oldest friends, Duke of Buckingham, was very much the leader of this sort of band of drinking, womanizing courtiers. He went into exile with Charles, and they grew up together. And apparently, Duke of Buckingham masturbated in Thomas Hobbes' geometry lessons.
Why did he really like geometry?
Who knows?
Yeah, good. Oh, can't quite process that. And we know this because Charles was just sort of recounting it as, you never guess what old what's his name did.
What Buckers was up to.
Buckers in geography, geometry.
Mm. When William III first visited England in 1670, he was absolutely appalled at the licentious court. He saw people relieving themselves just in the corner of the rooms.
It's been the word of the evening, but why? Why didn't they just go to the loo?
Well, I guess the corner of the room was closer.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's true. Yeah.
Are you also a bit appalled that they let spaniels eat at the table?
Was he talking about Charles? Well, yeah.
Though apparently the Duke of Buckingham did manage to get William drunk on one of these nights, and he ended up wandering into the room of one of the ladies at court and causing a bit of a scene.
Oh, I'd love the idea of William drunk sort of just flapping into a room going, excuse me. Oh, sweetie.
The Earl of Rochester described Charles II saying, "Restless he rolls from whore to whore, a merry monarch, scandalous and poor."
Ah, he's even called and poor?
Mm.
Poor as in his poor behaviour or he had no money?
Probably a lack of money, I think, rather. Than...
Okay. Yeah, he's even called scandalous in his day. That's pretty good.
He had a great number of mistresses.
Mm.
Nobles, French Catholics, actresses. He kind of treated his court as something of a harem. So he actually has them all living at court.
Just, and he, oh dear, like it just takes his pick each night. Right.
His wife wasn't too happy about this, particularly when his chief mistress, Barbara Villiers, was actually made Lady of the Bedchamber, which is a position relating to the Queen rather than...
Why did he do that? That sounds just mean.
Well, yeah, as I said, she wasn't very happy about it. I mean, again, he just thought logically, say, well, just, you know, she's a prominent person at court because she's my mistress. This is a position that's vacant. It would solve, you know, many problems.
Yeah, right, okay. And that's a position that she then had to give up when he moved on to the next person.
Well, he doesn't have to give up, does he? He could just take on new people rather than drop the old ones. The other, perhaps most famous one, is Nell Gwyn.
Yes. Great play. Did we see that together? The one with them... oh, God. We'll cut this again. We normally go through this. Bond Girl. Anyone seen that? Thank you, Gemma Arterton. Was it with you I saw that?
No.
Okay. Yes. It was a very good play.
She was a poor London girl who sold oranges and became an actress.
Yeah, that's her. Gemma Arterton.
Very cheerful and very cheerful and saucy character. She called him Charles III because he was her third Charles.
Oh, God. He was all right with that.
Yeah. Oh. And there was one time when she was in her carriage and a hostile crowd thought that she was a French Catholic mistress of Charles's.
Yeah.
And she popped her head out of the window and said, "Pray, good people, be silent. I am the Protestant whore."
It's a time of great openness and just very aware of who they are and where they stand in the situation.
Well, as was Charles. One time he was hailed by somebody at court as the father of his people. And he then laughed and said that he certainly had fathered a great number of them. He was apparently nicknamed Old Rowley after one of his favourite stallions.
Right.
He was literally a stud. Obviously.
Yeah.
And again, the Earl of Rochester. Charles's sceptre and his prick are of a length, but she who plays with one may sway the other.
I don't know where to start with that. If that's literally, that implies that in the bedroom... this great scepter is being whirled around the room. And it... Oh, no, I don't want to think of the opposite. Carry on.
Shall we move on to George IV?
Yes, please.
So, George, as you said, a bit of a rather disastrous young man.
Yeah.
1784, he got himself arrested.
Could he get arrested?
Well, yes, and he thought that this was a very good thing. He said, "Thank God the laws of this country are superior to rank. It should make an Englishman proud to see the Prince of Wales obliged to send for a tailor to bail him."
He's got a point, though. That's great.
In some ways, yes. In other ways, it's perhaps not the most laudable thing for the Prince of Wales to be doing.
No, I mean, I'd prefer to know that in theory that can happen than actually perhaps trying it out in practice.
Yeah, if Prince Charles did that and said, "You know, if you think about this, it's actually quite a good..."
I would admire him, his balls, to do that. That'd be fantastic.
He ran up extensive debts, George IV. In 1795, he had debts of something like £730,000, which might be about £50 million today.
How do you spend that much money?
Clothes, gambling, women, food.
Well done him. That's impressive.
He was granted an extra £65,000 and then another £60,000 in 1803, but continued to spend extravagantly. And his treasurer apparently admitted that his debts were ultimately beyond all kind of calculation whatsoever.
Wow. So it was the idea that this was okay because when he became king, the state would write them off? Or...
Well, it's not really okay. Because
No. But
ultimately, it's the state's money.
Yeah, but did he think that it would somehow be all right?
I don't think he really understood the concept of budgeting.
Okay. Right.
Spending, he'd got down to a T, but budgeting... Less so. He was a bit of a Henry VIII chap, as you said, in terms of his growth and his size. He has this great big corset built for himself. Gilray, a cartoonist, depicted him as a voluptuary under the horrors of digestion, where he's found slumped in his chair, his belly about to burst, surrounded by wines and bills that haven't been paid.
Sounds quite depressing.
Well, he is mercilessly attacked in the cartoons at the time. He's unfortunate to be around at the time when the cartoonist really become a thing, satirical cartoonist. Mm. So he is considered scandalous at the time because people are just mocking him all the time.
Yeah, poor bloke.
Poor old George. But he does get himself into some bother. Early on, it was a lady, Mary Robinson, who was an actress, and George wrote incriminating letters to her, describing everything that's been going on, all of his feelings towards her. So obviously she is a bit smarter than him, and so blackmails him.
Oh.
Because she's got all these letters from the Prince Regent.
But he was there...
He'll sign them and just talk about his love for her and all this sort of stuff.
He's done up like a kipper.
Well, he was, exactly. The Prime Minister had to purchase the letters back to prevent a scandal.
Mm. Yeah, oh gosh.
So if you're getting the Prime Minister involved...
Yeah, it's not good, is it? I can see why they didn't perhaps trust him to be king.
And as you said, Maria Fitzherbert, he becomes infatuated with a twice-widowed Roman Catholic commoner.
Mm.
And he first tried to get her to marry him by lightly cutting himself and pretending that he was dying.
He's completely deluded, isn't he?
They do marry for real in 1785, but he couldn't get a proper person to do it, so he has to get a priest from a debtor's prison to marry them.
And it is official, it's actually a marriage.
Well, except it's totally illegal because they have to get permission from the king.
Right.
And she's a Catholic, so he should have been barred from the succession because of this marriage.
So the fact that it was illegal meant that...
It would have been considered invalid. Okay, once he actually needs to get married, right. He could make that argument.
So it wasn't... Okay, got it. Yep.
But then when he eventually does marry to Caroline of Brunswick, it was pretty much a disaster zone for him that really adds more to his negative reputation. He wasn't very interested in the choice. So he just said that one damn German Frau is as good as another.
Oh, God. Oh, she must have felt so welcome.
When he met her, he thought that she was very coarse, outspoken, disinclined to wash.
But he sounds like he's describing himself.
Well, exactly. Apparently, when they first met, he then said to one of his attendants, "I am not well. Pray get me a glass of brandy."
Mm.
She said that he was very stout and very much not like his portrait.
Yeah.
Classic dating scenario.
Changing your age on your Tinder profile. I know what they're up to.
When they actually get married at the wedding, George was roaring drunk throughout the entire ceremony. He apparently at one point stood up suddenly for absolutely no reason during a prayer.
What a catch.
And then passed out in the bedroom fireplace that night.
With it lit?
Presumably not.
Okay, he wasn't rescued and beaten. Yeah. All right, okay, fine.
But he did manage the next morning, with probably a pretty bad hangover, to climb into bed. And 9 months later, they had a daughter.
Oh, that's tragic, isn't it? That's
efficient, though.
Yeah. And then they were never seen together again, or they just decided that they weren't for each other. I mean, she clearly decided from the outset that they weren't.
Well, 3 days after their daughter Charlotte was born, George made a new will declaring that Maria Fitzherbert was the wife of my heart and soul. And as I say, they did then separate. But Caroline returns for the accession, wanting to be crowned queen.
But she would legally have been queen.
Because they hadn't divorced initially. But she turned up to the coronation ceremony despite being banned. And she was wearing full-on velvet robes that she bought especially for the ceremony.
Did they let her in?
She wasn't let in. She didn't have a ticket. Name wasn't on the list.
Way.
But you can just imagine this sort of everybody there and then suddenly this big knock on the door and George's face going ashen white.
Oh, that seems a bit cruel. They could have just gone through the ceremony of it all and,
ignore that. Ignore that.
It's fine. She's not here. Nobody look at her. That would have been fine.
Yeah. As you said, he liked to pretend that Napoleon was his great rival and they were equals. But when Napoleon died and a servant came in to tell him that his greatest enemy was dead, he enthusiastically replied, "Is she, by God?"
Oh, brilliant. Brilliant.
So, I mean, they've both done
greatest
pretty
rival.
Well.
Wow. Yeah, they did
scandal.
Phenomenally well. Yeah.
I mean, how do you decide between them?
I think, for me, it sounds... Oh, no, hang on. I was going to say it sounds like Charles is less cruel, but Charles did the whole bedchamber thing.
He did.
Yeah.
Charles seems maybe a bit more in control of what he's doing, whereas George is just excess and...
Yeah. Yeah, as you're saying, he has no idea about budgeting, but he seems to have no idea about how a lot of things work.
Yeah.
Whereas Charles knew what he was doing and was quick-witted with it. And I think the funny stuff from George is just actually him, his real thoughts. He doesn't think about what he's saying. When he thinks that his greatest enemy is dead, he genuinely thinks this is his wife.
Yes, he does.
Yeah, so Charles for me.
Very close score-wise, Charles was just ahead, though. 16 out of 20 for Charles, and George IV got 15 out of 20.
Mm. Yeah, they're very equal so far.
Mm. Let's see how they do in the next factor.
Subjectivity. Yeah, third gig in, I've got them.
Charles II, there's quite a lot to like about Charles. As you said, the Merry Monarch. The Restoration, it's only 11 years since his father was executed and the country became a republic. So it's by no means guaranteed that monarchy will be a success when he comes back. But Charles offers a pardon to all who opposed him except for the regicides, the people that signed his father's death warrant, with this act of indemnity and oblivion. But he's also, as said, got that wry, slightly cynical sense of humour. So when we have the Restoration, everybody celebrating him, and I've just realised I probably wasn't talking to that very well, so is that better? Everyone can hear me, that's good. Everyone celebrating him, you've got all of the people around in London waving their flags, wines flowing everywhere, and all telling him how they would longed for his return for so many years, to which he responded that there were so many people wishing he'd returned, it must have been his own fault that he'd stayed away for so long.
It is, yeah, he does sound like, I can't remember who he said this about, but he sounds like he had the same scriptwriter as Roger Moore's 007, like some sort of witty aside for each thing. Brilliant.
And he is not one who is straight to the chop of the head sort of thing. He can see the funny side in things. So in 1671, there was a chap, Colonel Blood, who was caught red-handed trying to steal the crown jewels, sticking it, sort of down his trousers.
I think you've been reading a cartoon. Colonel Blood stealing the crown jewels.
Yes.
Brilliant, yeah.
Well, that's basically Charles's reaction. So when he was told about it, he roared with laughter, asked to meet him, and ended up giving him a royal position and a salary for life.
As royal robber? For what? Wow.
He just thought it was a great laugh.
Yeah. That's what we need. Courage, balls, look at this man. Ridiculous.
We'd had the all the puritanical stuff under Cromwell. Charles sweeps it away. Theatres are reopened and women are allowed on stage for the first time. We have notoriously bawdy comedies written, and Charles very much encourages this to be a thing that we can enjoy. Brings back Christmas, of course.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Banned by Cromwell.
Yeah. That's, sure. Was any of this like as a nod to the general public to try and win them on side? Or was this his view of the world?
I think it's his view of the world, I think it's fair to say. In science, he confers a royal charter, a charter on the Royal Society.
Oh,
so
yeah,
Wren,
yeah.
Hooke, Newton, yeah. Boyle, Halley, all around. He was very amused, apparently, at their attempts to try to weigh air.
Yeah, it must have looked hilarious. No.
He does encourage greater toleration in terms of religion. In 1660, he came back promising liberty to tender consciences.
Right, what does he mean?
He means that, whatever you want to do, that's fine. Let's not, like Elizabeth said, put windows into men's souls.
Oh, okay. And did they mean it this time? Was that it after that?
Well, he meant it. Unfortunately, Parliament didn't necessarily agree with him at the time, but he meant it. He intervened to free 700 Quakers from jail on one occasion. It was accepted that they weren't a threat to anybody and were peaceful.
Yeah, the Quakers aren't a threat to anyone.
No, but at the time, they were, dissenters. People didn't really like that. But Charles is fine. He and his brother James are on the scene when we have the Great Fire of London. James was directing the firefighters and Charles was encouraging the soldiers in creating a block to try and stop the fire.
Oh, wow.
And Charles also went on scene to try and help the people in the refugee area in Moorfield. So he orders distribution of food. And when there's an hysteria of people saying that the whole fire was started by Catholics, he really gets in there and says, no, it definitely wasn't just an accident. Calms it all down.
Yeah. Okay. So this is that his Catholic sympathies, or he's just straightforward trying to control a crowd? I mean, was he literally in the middle of the crowd saying it wasn't Catholics?
And he's probably not right in the middle of it, but he is there, probably maybe on his horse or, little stage perhaps.
Lovely.
Maybe dressed up.
Mm. Oh, inevitably dressed up. Get me my speaker's costume.
Now, despite having lots and lots of affairs, in some ways, he was quite a good husband.
Are you sure?
He does to who exactly? He does generally care for his wife, for Catherine. When she fell seriously ill, he sat with her for hours, was deeply moved when, in a fever, she thought herself pregnant. And then bid him to try and marry somebody else.
Oh, that's so sad.
And when we have the exclusion crisis and the many people in Parliament worried about his brother becoming king, some of the Tories urge him to divorce and marry someone else so that he can produce an heir. But apparently he refused to divorce her and said that, considering my faultiness towards her, I think it a horrid thing to abandon her.
Oh, he's lovely, old Charles. He's sweet. He's got some insight as well. Unlike George, perhaps.
And he's got a bit of that wit as well. Earl of Rochester again, at court, presumably, actually says
this
to Charles. Is this
the masturbator?
No.
Okay.
We have a pretty witty king, and whose word no man relies upon. He never said a foolish thing, and never did a wise one.
Oh, he's been practicing that, hasn't he?
To which Charles responds, "That's true, for my words are my own, but my actions are those of my ministers."
Ah, lovely. Well done, Charles.
Against him, unfortunately, despite his best intentions, there isn't great tolerance in this period in terms of religion. Intolerant acts against dissenters and Catholics ultimately hold sway. Quakers are persecuted, and Scottish Presbyterians also are brutally suppressed by government. So he isn't actually able to achieve his aims.
But he's trying. He's trying to push the other way. It's just that he doesn't have the power.
Trying to, he just doesn't manage it. He never actually really wins MPs over because they suspect him of being an absolutist. And say the exclusion crisis got dangerously close to it all starting to kick off again. And he does ultimately solve the problem by just not calling Parliament again. So that's fine because he died a few years later, but how long would it have gone on before he next called Parliament? How much would tensions have risen? We'll never know.
What ifs? And so far, all we know is that he sorted it out.
Exactly. It's the opposite to what you've been saying every other night when you said if only the king hadn't died, he could have just gone on and done so much more.
With him, it's like just die quickly. Get it done.
Now. But he was quite realistic about the situation, I think, with the exclusion crisis. His brother James was apparently concerned about the security arrangements and Charles' safety. But to which Charles replied, "Don't worry, Jamie. They'll never kill me to make you king."
Oh, God. Yeah, you'd laugh. Go, oh, yes, good point. Poor bloke.
He's also a little bit lazy.
Yeah, very.
Doesn't really like to do the work. The Earl of Clarendon said that he was a bit depressed about how Charles wouldn't do anything. "He hath more judgment and understanding by many degrees than many who pretend it. And that is the only thing that breaks my heart, that he makes no more use of it."
Of his power?
Of his intelligence and his capacity.
Okay. But he is pushing for certain things like the religious toleration and stuff. But so he's just got boxes of work piling up and saying, just sign those somewhere. Yeah, my approach to life. God, I like him.
We do also, unfortunately, have in 1672 the creation of the Royal African Company.
I've never heard of that. Apart from when you told me this the first time around, but it's on the same lines as the East India Company.
No, this is the start of the organized transatlantic slave trade, which technically does start under Charles. It's perhaps more his brother that really seems to get into it.
Yeah.
In an unpleasant way, but that's nevertheless not the best of things to have started.
No, how can we turn that into a positive?
Let's talk about George IV instead.
Yes.
He's also a bit of a bon viveur. Good host at parties. Apparently a talented mimic.
Oh, yeah?
As well, good impressions. Charles Burney said that George had as much wit as Charles II with much more learning.
Don't believe him.
Yes, I mean, unless Charles Burney was sort of about 150 years old, I'm not sure how he'd able to actually make that comparison.
Do we know who he did impressions of?
I guess just people at court.
Apparently the Queen is a very good mimic. Have you heard that? I've never heard her do anything, but I've just heard that she is.
He's quite a kind man on a personal level. He gave readily to hospitals and orphanages, supported the establishment of the RSPCA, And constantly interceded for clemency for capital punishment, and apparently was always very pleased whenever he succeeded.
Okay. RSPCA is quite a big one. I didn't realise it was that old.
Yeah.
Established way before the NSPCC. Yeah. It's telling.
He tended to judge people by their actions rather than their background. So all servants were given generous pensions and a Christmas party, and apparently he used to join them.
I bet he did.
On one occasion he heard that a certain pub in London had the best ale. So he went along, had a pint, and chatted to the locals.
As king? People knew who he was?
Maybe not as king, but as prince.
Wow.
And he also apparently used to quite enjoy boxing.
Oh, I like him a lot. Good. Right.
Until he saw a man killed. But he settled an annuity upon his widow.
Right.
That's nice.
I suppose he's got very little to do apart from party, and he's got all this money that he's insisting on spending and giving away. That's how he got
some of it. He spends quite well.
Yeah, the odd bit he gives to other people.
The Regency is a flowering of fashion, arts, literature, and architecture, and George's a key figure in all of this as a patron and collector. Jane Austen's Emma is dedicated to him, albeit quite grudgingly.
Did they meet?
They didn't meet. He had apparently a copy of all of her books in all of his palaces.
Wow.
Because he loved them so much. But yeah. She sympathised with the wife and wasn't so pleased that her publisher said it might be a good idea to give her
a
dedication. Yeah. But still, his name's in there.
Yeah, pretty good.
He popularised buttons.
Right.
Oh, you have buttons.
I've
maybe not today.
One.
But you've got one button. Where's your button?
I don't really want to show it.
Okay.
Two, then, if we're being technical.
He improved public access to the arts. He brought back a lot of Charles I's art collection that had been sold off by Cromwell, donated his father's 65,000-volume library to the British Museum, and supported the foundation of the National Gallery.
Wow.
And he said, I have not formed it for my own pleasure alone, but to gratify the public taste.
That's cool. It's like, but Charles did the Royal Society one.
Yeah.
I'm getting confused. Okay, right, fine, carry on.
We also have the Catholic Emancipation and Relief Act, major legislation allowing Catholics the right to sit in Parliament, and then he removes the Test and Corporation Acts requiring receiving the sacrament and not denying transubstantiation, i.e. not being a Catholic.
So he lets people be Catholics?
He lets people be Catholic and hold public office.
Okay.
But and that's from 1673, which was actually enacted in the reign of Charles II.
That's what I was about to say. Was that... That was started under Charles, and people finally got the idea that they weren't evil people. Mm. Right, okay.
Ireland, he went on tour in 1821, the first monarch to visit peacefully from Britain.
Mm. Right.
He was met by large cheering crowds. He spoke to a farmer who didn't have a cow, so he bestowed a cow upon him.
Was he a cow farmer? Or was he was mostly crop farming? He said, well, I'm not going to do this cow. It's only a mocking my skills.
Going to eat everything.
Yeah. Well, it's a nice thought.
It was a nice thought. He then made
a farmer who didn't have a cow. Are you sure he was a farmer?
Well, he asked him, and then he said, yes, I'm a farmer. He said, do you have a cow? And he said, no. So he said, well, then you shall have one.
It's just living a different world. Yeah. Absolutely crazy. I swear he's off his rocker.
He then invites this huge crowd to follow him to his house and makes a speech in front of them and bestows lots and lots of whiskey.
Right. Brilliant. I mean, that's flawless. That's a great gig. Just throwing up. You're not getting any whiskey. Yeah.
He then went to Scotland in 1822. This is the first visit since...
Don't know.
Charles II in 1651.
Right, yeah. Okay, good.
It was organised by Sir Walter Scott.
Mm.
So he insisted on everyone wearing tartan, and George absolutely loves it. So rather ironically, he wears the Stuart tartan, given all the business that had happened with Bonnie Prince Charlie not so long ago.
So he insisted everyone dress up. There's a lot of parallels here.
They like dressing up.
Yeah.
And George absolutely loves it. He loves whiskey. He loves the porridge. He loves the dancing.
Yeah. It's like he's discovered this country on his doorstep that he rules. And he thinks it's brilliant. Fantastic.
And it's sort of from this visit that we actually start to see the tartan and noble Highlander images like appearing on shortbread tins and that kind of thing. That's where it becomes again a popularised image.
Mm. Bagpipes? Do you like those?
Probably.
I went to Edinburgh recently. We're going to Glasgow. And the entire trip was just in the background, this incessant drone on every single street corner. You go into a cafe and they'll be playing bagpipe music. Oh, so I'm pleased to get on the plane. We love you, Scotland.
Some less positive things about George IV.
Right.
As you said, the regency crisis, when George III was ill, they really didn't want to have him as regent if they could avoid it. He was apparently engaging in political intrigue the whole time with Fox and the Whigs, and was said to have impersonated George in the pubs, as in George in his state of madness in the pubs, which isn't the nicest of things to have been doing. And the fact that he was so partial and unfit to rule is the reason there was a crisis.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't believe... I don't understand why Fox was getting in with him if he was so unreliable and such a
well, because Fox was a radical out of power, and then you've got the man who is going to become king knocking on your door.
Okay, so it still worked. They still had enough power that was worthwhile being mates.
Yeah.
Okay. Right.
Didn't work out for either of them, but nevertheless, it was a good idea.
Mm.
When he died, the Times gave perhaps not the best obituary that you might hope to receive, as well any kind of person, but certainly a king. A hard-drinking, swearing, whoring man who at all times would prefer a girl and a bottle to politics and a sermon, whose only states of happiness were gluttony, drunkenness, and gambling. There never was an individual less regretted by his fellow creatures than this deceased king.
Wow, that's horrible. Poor guy. Like, especially for this family reading that. Just, there's got to be a nice way of putting it. It feels like he's writing such a bad one, he's hoping George will read it. Yeah. Really bad.
Imagine David Dimbleby saying that, you know, at a royal funeral.
Yeah, awful. Right, so he was very hated in some quarters.
He was, and despite passing some of that good reform, George himself actually wasn't really in favour of it, and it was very reluctant.
So that's where it finished. We were just talking about George the Fourth and the ways in which he wasn't perhaps the best king that there'd ever been, and then the episode cut out, unfortunately. Not at live at the time, but subsequently recording.
Yeah. Right, so, I mean, what happened?
Well, so then obviously we went on to talk about Dynasty, where Charles II didn't have any surviving children, and in fact neither did George the Fourth. Surviving legitimate children, that is. Obviously, yeah. Charles II had plenty of...
which is almost a miracle for both of these people.
And longevity beforehand, which you would always forget the order, and now I've done it as well.
Is it that way around?
Longevity, dynasty.
Okay.
Rex Factor. So, then, as with all knights, we got the audience to vote for who was the best, the most raucous, whichever way people chose to interpret it. We maybe hadn't been clear enough.
I think that was the problem with this episode, if there were, because were we saying which was a better king or which was more raucous? So, you decide.
Well, I didn't decide. The audience in Oxford decided, whichever way they chose to interpret it. And I think it's fair to say that the vote wasn't particularly close. I think George the Fourth got about 3 votes.
Really?
And everybody else went for Charles II. It was very, very one-sided.
Right. I mean, I sort of remember, I think, from that episode, thinking that actually it was difficult because Charles came across as much more genial than George the Fourth.
Yeah.
He was a bit more of a bit more slobby.
Yes. I think that's the thing. I think we probably made it a bit too much who was the better king.
Yeah.
In which case, it's obviously Charles. If we'd made it a bit more about being raucous, perhaps George would have got some more votes.
Yeah.
So I think when we did subsequent episodes, like the so-called baddies, the next one we did in Leeds, we really played up to the what makes a good villain, rather than just who ruled better.
Yeah, but we're getting slicker and slicker with each one.
I'm afraid I can't remember the full sort of half hour of questions and answers.
Nor me either.
That then followed. So apologies to anyone came to Oxford and was hoping to hear those questions answered a second time. because those unfortunately have been lost. But we had a lot of fun afterwards. I think as a proportion of the audience, that was the most amount of people that we then got to have a drink and a gin.
Oh, in Oxford.
Afterwards. Yeah.
Yeah, that was great. There was a huge, great table of us, wasn't there? Yeah. Oh, it was just such a small little bar. It was just the bar. But yeah, so thanks everyone for coming. It was really good fun.
And Privy Councillors who are enjoying the tour diaries will find that this was, I think, our longest one, and certainly from your perspective, probably mine as well, but definitely from your perspective, the drunkest tour diary episode.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that sort of goes hand in hand, doesn't it? We had great fun socialising at the end. Now listen to the tour diary. Oh, I haven't heard that. Well,
sign up to be a Privy Councillor, Ali, and you get to relive.
Oh, I don't know that I want to hear that.
What you sound like at the end of the night.
I don't know that I want any... So what we've done is just put this out to the world of me being drunk.
Yep.
I left Facebook for this reason. Brilliant.
Anyway, hope you enjoyed the live episode. Sorry that we didn't quite have the full amount, but that's the only one that happened. So 1 in 6 for our first ever live tour.
Not bad. Yeah. Not bad at all.
Bye.
Bye-bye.